This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So I had the great privilege of working with Yana for 23 years, and I actually had some collaborations with him for a few years before that. So I've had a lot of good memories and a lot of learned a lot from watching him do his work. We worked together. It was my job to present to you not only the work he's done, but also try to talk to you a little bit about him as a human being. So I'll try to do that as well. Yana lived his life very fully, and he had a great time. Like he said, he was having fun all the time. It's kind of neat to see him think about how, you know, he thought he was going to die during the war, and then once he survived it, he felt like, okay, this is my job now to enjoy life. So Yana started off in Hokkaido, Japan. So he started off, he was born in the northern island of Japan where it gets really, really cold in the winter. And so he did his BS in biology, and he did a PhD in embryology, all right in the same place. But then, like he said, he wrote to this guy, M.C. Chang. So M.C. Chang turned out to be a huge turning point in his life. In 1960, he moved to work to the Worcester Foundation to work with this guy. He had just written to him, and the guy took him because he already had a couple of publications as a PhD. And so M.C. Chang took him, and I think that affected his life a lot. And we'll see later as we talk about cloning at the end of the talk that one of the principles that M.C. Chang taught him about how to teach people actually ended up with cloning. So we'll come back to that. In 1964, after he finished his work, his postdoc, he went back to Japan. And he got a job at a teaching university in Hokkaido. But he really wanted to do research. And Yana got so well known in the field that lots of people asked him to write sort of my life story type thing. So you can find a couple of reviews about him like that. And in one of those, he mentioned he went back to Japan and they would only let him teach. And so he took a year off without pay to do research. And he published a couple of papers while he was doing that. And then in 1964, because of the work that he did as a postdoc, he was already gaining notoriety. Most of us don't gain notoriety in our postdocs. Take it from me, I can tell you. But Yana had already published some seminal papers in that 4 years that he was with M.C. Chang. And so the guy that was starting a medical school in Hawaii invited him to come and look at it. So he flew to Hawaii, saw it, and then went back to Japan and talked to Noyes and told him he was coming. And there he came back in 1966, and he spent the rest of his life there. And he became so famous that he was considered for the Nobel Prize a couple of times. He was on the short list many times for the Nobel Prize. But he stayed in Hawaii partly out of loyalty, because Hawaii gave him a chance. So he always said that. He always come back, Hawaii gave me this chance to do research. And he's the guy that took it on upon himself to do it. So just, you have to talk about the numbers and things, but Yana published over 400 papers. He was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2021, and I can tell you that I did my postdoc at Hopkins, and I tried to call a friend of my mentors, Judah Folkman at Harvard, who was a National Academy member. I said, how do we get Don Coffey elected to the Academy? He said, well, it's a Big Brother thing. Hopkins, they have a lot of National Academy members. You got to get them to nominate him. That's how it works. But there weren't many National Academy members at the University of Hawaii. When he got nominated, it was because somebody took one of their, slots and said, this guy deserves it, and really pushed it through. So that National Academy Award was really a great, great thing. And Yana wasn't political, so he never lobbied for this at all. Somebody pushed him to do it. In 1996, he won the International Prize for Biology. We always called the Emperor's Award. And here's an old, really bad photograph of him accepting the prize from the Emperor. This is one of the most proudest moments of his life. But I can tell you that one of the most proudest moment of his life was the Enormi Foundation Award, the Kyoto Prize. He was so excited about this. He was working on this for months. He couldn't wait to prepare for it. When they came to visit him, I was out of town that year, that month. I was in Europe when they came, so I didn't get to see the crew who came to film. That's why I'm not in any of the movies. But he really enjoyed it. This was the last part of his life was filled with joy for getting this prize. He would have loved to have met Princess Takamoto, I think. He would have loved this. It would have been a great joy of his life. He enjoyed life, okay? So one of the things he told us, he has, We got this new building. They built a new building for him, the Institute for Biogenesis Research, in 2000. And he was going around tacking up walls, you know, on our nice walls, he would tack up a sign that was important for us. He didn't care what it looked like, just so that it was effective. One of them was, be outstanding, excellent is not enough. And this is from the old NIH standards, where they used to say, the score is outstanding is the top score, excellent is a good score, but not great, good is okay, and then, you know, fair, and then not good. So you have to be outstanding to get funding. So you have to be, you know, you can't be good. He was an example of hard work. Like he said in the movie, he loved to work with his hands. At 95, he was still doing experiments in this little lab across the street, across the hallway from his office. He was still, you know, the sea urchin thing that they showed you wasn't just something that they wanted to show. I needed to do an experiment with sea urchin eggs for my work, and he said, okay, let's start tomorrow. So he took my postdoc, they went out to the ocean, picked up some sea urchins, and brought them back, and that was him teaching her how to do this. So we, you know, he would just do it. If you wanted to do something with Jana, you had to be prepared to do it the next day. If you said, okay, let's collaborate, he goes, great, let's do it tomorrow. In 2004, we had a flood that put 4 feet of water in the first floor of our IBR. Luckily, the labs were on the second floor. Jana called me up. I was at a Halloween party, because Steve, can you stop by the lab? This is Saturday night. Steve, can you stop by the lab? We have a flood. And we used to have these floods all the time, like a pipe leaking or something. I said, yes, Jana, I'll stop by. He says, call me back. No, Steve, you really need to come. I said, okay, fine, I'll come. And I got there, and we have like 5 inches of water, mud on the floor. Jana is already cleaning his books with the hairdryer on Saturday night. He's already starting to clean. So I sent him home, and we started cleaning up the next week. But he was already there. He was helping us. The next 2 weeks, we cleaned out all the mud. We organized everybody to get everybody out, and Jana was right there with us. He had a great sense of humor. There was this guy that was particularly, you know, not a great colleague in the faculty. He said, you know, every time I ask him for a favor, he asks me for 10. So that's the way. He had a sense of adventure. When he was 93, he decided to go visit Alaska by himself. He took a plane and you know, took a helicopter tour. He would take helicopter tours, you know, because he wanted to get it done. Science far, far, far outweighed any kind of administrative thing he did. So when they, University of Hawaii and its great, you know, wisdom gave him an institute so they could propel his career. He had no idea how to navigate the deans and chairs and stuff like that. And so he hired me to come and help with, you know, I had already collaborated with him. And he sends me an email when I'm in New Jersey. Dear Steve, the university has given me 5 positions. Would you like to join my group? End of story. That was it. That was my invitation letter. That was my recruitment letter. And so it wasn't until I talked to the dean and we got things worked out and made it actual possible that I could go. But he hated the administrative stuff. So, but he was a good friend too. He really liked it. He was a great person to have around. This is him looking at a chrysalis, you know, watching a dragonfly come out in Wales, visiting another professor that we knew. So Jana, as he said, I witnessed the moment the sea urchin fertilization, the egg of activation. When he witnessed that, when he saw that, it was like a thing came on in his life, and that's what he wanted to study, fertilization. And his goal always was to see it somehow, either with his own eyes, through the microscope, through the electron microscope. He thought if we could see it, we could do it. And in his, he always talks about this one quote that he found. The child does not inherit its characteristics from the parent body, from the germ cells. As far as the heredity is concerned, the body is merely the carrier of the germ cells. So he was always focused on sperm and egg. That was to him the seed of life, right? That's how it goes. So I had the great privilege in my life of being mentored by Don Coffey, who is a really fantastic leader, prostate cancer world expert at Hopkins. And once when I was down visiting him, he would draw on his napkins. He goes, look, Steve, this is not thinking. He drew a circle with a big arrow. And he said, this is thinking. He drew a circle with arrows coming all around it. And when we wrote a memorandum for Coffee, I put this together for him. But then I realized that Jana's the same way. So Jana was focused on fertility, and he would go after it in any way possible. It wasn't just that he said, okay, I'm going to be the expert on sperm swimming to the egg and getting in. He studied the ovary. He studied the cortical granules. Any question I could ask him about sperm or egg, I would go to him and ask him, and he would know it. He was known mostly for sperm, but he did a lot of other stuff as well. So Jana's success was he was really probably one of the world's experts on mammalian fertility in all aspects, not just, okay, here's the sperm guy, here's the egg guy. Our society, the Society for Study of Reproduction, is sort of divided in sperm and egg people, right? But Jana was really both. He went after fertility from all aspects. So Jana was this leader in fertility, right? We always have the tendency to say, okay, this was the great scientist because he or she discovered this, right? But that's not what a true great scientist usually is. A true great scientist has a body of work, right? I was in Barcelona once and went to the Picasso Museum, and I was really surprised to see that his earlier works were like Rembrandts. Picasso painted pictures where they looked like photographs. He was absolutely excellent at it, and then he went off to this weird Cubist stuff. But it was because he had established himself as this expert in, you know, in the techniques at the time that people said, okay, if he's doing it, maybe Cubism is something we should pay attention to. And Jana was like this. He was so prolific over his career. He was so utterly focused on fertilization, but he was so creative in how he looked at it. And I hope to show you a couple of these things. That he quickly became sort of the person to go to on fertility questions. And just about any question in fertility, you could probably find an important paper that he wrote on it, right? And so you add this to the fact that he really enjoyed people, right? He enjoyed working with people. The first time that I ever worked with Jana, I didn't have a whole lot of grant money, neither did Jana, but he knew my work, and there was one experiment I wanted to do. He said, great, you can come out here for 2 weeks. I said, sure. When I got out there, he took me to his apartment, and I stayed in his apartment for 6 days. We had never met. So I stayed in the second, you know, bedroom two of his second apartment. I had to leave the last day because he was going out of town, and no way could I stay in the apartment with his wife, you know. So I had to stay with somebody else the last night. But, you know, he brought me into his home. I mean, I was so embarrassed. I couldn't understand it, but he was a great guy to live with. This is one of my favorite stories of Anna's interactions. So I don't know if you guys caught it, but there was a book that said Chapter 5, Fertility, right? So Jana was asked to write this Chapter 5 of this book, this huge manuscript. Again, when I was an assistant professor in New Jersey, he sends me a letter, can I use your figures, Steve? So I had published a review article where I talked about how chromatin was folding different in the nucleus versus in the sperm nucleus versus other nuclei. And I said, great, yeah, sure, I'll send you this really detailed quality of it. He goes, thank you. And I thought, you know, most of us when we write reviews, we write maybe 5-10 figures, you know, and then we bang it out like that. I have a friend of mine who says, you can write me a review, Steve, it's 5,000 words, I can do that in a day, right? This guy down in Australia. So Jana finally published this paper that I was, you know, this chapter that I was so thrilled to be a part of. It had 96 figures. Mine was number 81. He had 1,735 references. Jana was very meticulous about referencing everybody. In fact, when I wanted to prepare this talk for you guys, I thought, well, we have everything on his computer because he needed help with all the time, so we knew how to get to it. We had his talk that he was going to give, but I couldn't use it. Because most of the talk that he planned to give to the Kyoto people was about how everybody else did work. And when Jana says eventually researchers realized, he meant to say, I discovered, okay, in the field right there as I was watching that. So Jana was extremely meticulous. He was extremely, you know, he knew the field. He wanted to give everybody else credit, right? But he was the one who did things. So before I go further, I've got to tell you some of the answers before we go further, because otherwise you won't understand the impact of it, right? So right now we know that fertilization is a very difficult process. What we don't know is this is a mouse uterus, and uterus has two uteri. It's kind of like a Y-shaped uterus. So the mouse uterus is like this, and then this is the fallopian tube that goes to the ovary. I never realized this until I basically talked to Jana, but when mammalian fertilization, the sperm after ejaculation goes into the uterus, it has to swim up the fallopian tube and get to the ovary before it fertilizes, right? And during this process of swimming, this process called capacitation occurs. So the sperm that come out of the egg, that you know, even ejaculated, early ejaculated sperm are not ready for fertilization. They have to change their membranes first. My wife, who's also a scientist, has, I'll show you the picture later, the sperm has to get dressed for work. And so this is called capacitation. And so this was a very sort of, you know, when sea urchin sperm fertilizes an egg, it just goes in the seawater. So you can do that in the laboratory very easily. Seawater's easy. But recreating this process is not easy. But when the sperm also has this shell around it called a zona pellucida, the sperm has to swim to the egg, it has to drill through this zona, and then it has to fuse with the egg, and then the nucleus has to go in. So this is an extremely complicated process. Jana made very significant contributions to every one of these things. Like I said, I cannot tell you everything he did. So also, I want to give you one more primer on mammalian fertilization, which is very interesting to me anyway. A lot of people actually. But see. So the sperm, the egg, when it's ready for fertilization, still has the last division of chromosomes. When sperm and egg go to they have to get rid of half their chromosomes. And the way they do it is kind of weird. They double them first, and then they get rid of half, and then they get rid of the second half. So this is the second the egg is ready to lose its second half of chromosomes. When the sperm comes in, which's already lost, only has half the chromosomes, fertilizes the egg, that activates the egg to go through this second process. The two sets of chromosomes then form little pronuclei instead of the egg, and they actually replicate before they ever come together. So this is very interesting to watch. This is very important. These pronuclei, the ability of the sperm to go from sperm to pronucleus is the first sign of fertilization. And so Jana used this a lot in his early work. And then they come together, the chromosomes come together. Interestingly, they sort of stay apart. The male, the paternal and maternal chromosomes stay apart for the first eight or nine divisions of the egg. But that's not important for here. Okay, so Jana's work. Jana, as I said, published over 400 papers, and he made significant contributions to every aspect of fertility. I'm going to try to focus on four major discoveries, and these discoveries happen in chronological order, and they're what Jana did to it, okay? So I'll talk about in vitro fertilization. First, the ultimate study of fertilization and the beginning of ART. ART is assisted reproductive technology. So this is how we help infertile couples humanity in general, infertile couples. Intracytoplasmic injection, so this is just letting the sperm swim to the egg. This is putting the sperm into the egg with a needle. And then this is taking an earlier sperm, and then this is cloning. So I gave this talk, this presentation, to a couple of my colleagues at work, including my wife, who's much more critical of me than most people. And I was told that some of the slides are very complicated that I'm going to show you. But I view this talk as sort of a legacy, and I wanted to make sure that all the data were there. So what I did was, in some of the most complicated slides, the most important thing that I'm going to say is in these yellow boxes, so you can see it more easily, right? So, and then you can read all the rest of it if you want. So let's talk about in vitro fertilization. Now, Jana was pursuing this, as he said. He sort of hinted at what was going on in this movie. It's really fun to watch after preparing this talk. But he really wanted to go after in vitro fertilization. He wasn't trying to cure human infertility. He wanted to see that what was happening inside the mouse, like he could with the sea urchin. But that problem was that he did embrace, when the clinician started to do this, he quickly embraced and helped them. And I'll show you one example where he actually did that. But his reason for doing it was because he wanted to see it in a test tube, because then he could study it. Right? He can't study it if it's happening deep inside the ovary inside a mouse. And so, again, this is the fertilization, right? The problem was, this is a very unique environment, right? We're talking about inside a tube off of one organ, and the chemical environment in that organ is completely unknown. And it's not like you can get buckets of it and purify it and reproduce it in the lab, right? So this was the real problem. So this is what Jana went to MC Chang to work with. Before I get to that, let me just point. So Jana studied in vitro fertilization in MC Chang's lab. In his postdoc, in his 4 years, he came out with 9 papers. You know, 3 of them were seminal, okay? So most of us are lucky to get 3, 4, maybe 5 papers out of our postdoc. Jana had 4 years, he got 9. The first one was a Nature paper, right, that showed rodent IVF. But this was even better than it wasn't the first mammalian IVF, but it was the first mammalian IVF where they didn't have to use this follicular fluid. Just interestingly enough, you know, back in those days, Nature was 2 pages. We didn't have all these pages and pages of we could put of supplementary data. So they just published the finding in Nature, and then a year later, they actually talked about the technique in a different, the same thing, but they actually described the technique in another paper. But if you go through these titles, you'll see that even in his first foray into mammalian fertilization, he was doing everything he probably could. There's a paper on the process, how the sperm enters the egg. There's a paper on the estrous cycle of the hamster nucleus, of the hamster female. There's a paper on how the egg changes. There's a paper on capacitation. So he looked at every aspect of this already. He was looking at every way he could do. So let's look at this paper in Nature, which is the one that got him, probably got him his job in Hawaii, frankly, but is the one that set him off as an early, you know, one of these rising stars. And what he did was he was able to get fertilization of a hamster sperm nucleus. So here's that sperm nucleus coming in, and there's turning into this pronucleus, right? So remember I said that when the sperm comes in, it has to decondense and become a pronucleus. So that's all he did at this stage was just, he considered fertilization the process of the egg turning into that nucleus. But the technical thing of it is, the paper doesn't really say it, but he said it later on. The real discovery from this paper was that sperm could be capacitated in vitro. In other words, you could take the sperm, you could dress them for work like you were supposed to, and then you could get it done. So that magical environment, really, the capacitation occurs somewhere as the sperm travels up this fallopian tube, and now it's ready. So the sperm here aren't ready to fertilize, but this, when they swim through here, they somehow get ready to fertilize, right? And so he was able to get this sperm capacitated in vitro, and that was the real discussion. And later on, Jana says, you know, this finding down here is in one of his, you know, my life and work and stuff, he said that it was this finding that gave researchers who were trying to do IVF, gave them hope that we could do this inside the test tube and that it could actually work. So one of my favorite papers is this one that he did, that I've dug up, that he did this. This is, I think he was putting this together when he was doing that year where he wasn't get paid in Japan. But I want you to look at, this is, he watched a sperm, when he did this, he was able to set up this in vitro fertilization. So now when he looked at it, he could see the fertilization occur in the egg. He watched it come to the egg, come to the zona pellucida, it drilled through. If you follow these time zones here, you see that he was waiting, this is like 10 hours, I can't see it here because it's too small for me, but it's 10 hours, 10.4, 10.35. I mean, he's following this meticulously to the minute, and I guarantee you that he drew these things himself when he made this study. Later on, when he published a review of this, he had much more detailed experiments. Here's a sperm tail caught in this furrow that's digging through here. And here's how the sperm goes through here. So he's really describing this process. So he was the first one. So he wanted to do in vitro fertilization, and he could describe it that way. And then here's some later on when he got to Hawaii. He trained his wife because, you know, he figured she needed something to do. He trained his wife to do electron microscopy, and she became very good electron microscopist. And so these are pictures of a hamster sperm nucleus coming into an egg. These are 3 different examples because you can't, you know, once you fix them, they don't go forward. So he really wanted to see that this was happening. So one of his first papers when he got to Hawaii was to focus on this capacitation. And this is the slide that my wife uses in her fertility talks for the students at UH. So she has this picture here to verify. So, and that capacitation, he showed that capacitation is, that requires calcium to do this. So he was able to show this. He was also, He made a lot of contributions to what's called the acrosome reaction. So the acrosome reaction, the acrosome is basically this bag of enzymes that the sperm carries on his head that it releases to drill through this zona to get through it. So this is like this, you know, the bag of tools that come across. And Jana, because he had this huge knowledge of models, right? He would always go to the right model for the right question. And the guinea pig has this huge giant acrosome. So if you want to study the acrosome, the guinea pig is the model you want to do. So he got some guinea pigs and he looked at this. And these are some electron micrographs that his wife prepared for him, or he might have done it himself. I don't know where this actually switched from him doing it to her doing it. But you can see that these massive changes that occur just before the acrosome releases its enzymes to sort of drill through that package. And he was able to show that capacitation requires calcium, but the acrosome reaction does not. And then later on, as he got better and better with this electron microscope, he could really go to the mouse and to the hamster and show the detail what happens. You know, that here's the acrosome, you get several different breaks in this membranes and it sort of all pops open. And then when it's released, now you have this nice clear sperm nucleus that's inside that fertilizes the egg. So the egg, he really showed that this egg carries this group of enzymes that's necessary to drill through that zona to get into the egg. So IVF was, people were looking for IVF. I mean, his goal for developing IVF was to study the biology of the disease. Remember he said in the movie that you should encourage students to study their work because you can never know when something is going to help, right? You never know when something is going to be important. I was talking to a group before the meeting today about polymerase chain reaction, right? So the polymerase PCR is possible today because somebody was studying Thermophilus aqueus, this bacteria that lives in 140 degree water in Yellowstone Park. Who knew that that discovery would allow us to do the greatest medical technology we use right now in looking at DNA and analyzing. I mean, my son, I can take him to the pediatrician, they can tell me if his nose is a bacterial or a viral infection because of PCR, because somebody studied, you know, bacteria in hot springs. So this is how Jana approached research, you know, just go after it and someday it might be useful. But when the people who saw that he was working, so now in 1976, he's only 10 years into his career. People from Australia and England are sort of both trying to develop IVF, and the people in Australia said, "Would you come down here and help us?" And they actually got, Jana worked with this guy, they published a paper where they got human sperm to fertilize a human egg, you know, in culture, and they published this. So they helped one group do it, and now we have about 750,000 babies born every year to ICSI and IVF every year. So the summary of IVF is that Jana's early interest was in seeing fertilization, right? That's what led him to do this. That's what led him to try to develop, to allow sperm to fertilize the egg in vitro. But because of his combination of creative experiments and vast knowledge of the field and dedication to this, he had several major contributions to this, and because of that, the clinicians came to him and asked him to do some work with them, and he helped, and he was really working to help them. So what about intracytoplasmic sperm injection? So this is when you take the sperm and you inject it into the egg. So for clinicians, there's a lot of people that have, you know, the sperm is fine, it can swim to the egg and fertilize in vitro, but they just have other problems. But there's a lot of men who have sperm that can't swim. And so, you know, now, and the method of choice for AIRT now is using ICSI. But Jana's real interest was in trying to separate these two different parts of the sperm cell. And we'll see this when we get to Rossi next, that he really did this. So the sperm really has two jobs, right? The sperm has to take one copy of the genome and carry it all the way to the egg. So the genome in the sperm cell is 3 feet of DNA. So the human sperm has 3 feet of DNA. It's very, very thin, so it fits in the volume. And if you shake DNA, it's a very long molecule. If you just shake it, you break it, right? Shake and break. So the sperm cell has to carry this, and it has to carry it through swimming and carrying it miles and miles, relatively speaking. So it's a big transition. The egg just sits there and waits for it to come, so it can hold its DNA safe and sound. deep in the pelvis, hidden by bone, but the sperm has to travel from one organism to the other. It's like taking your best set of china from New York and taking it out to Hawaii without a single chip in it, right? A single mutation, you know, would do this. So the sperm has evolved this ways to condense the DNA into this crystalline-like state. But that's only one job, is to carry it, right? The other job is to have the DNA safe when it gets there. So it has two different jobs, fertilization, and then it has to take the job to development. So like Jana, he knew that the sperm was very highly condensed, and he wondered if a dead sperm could fertilize an egg if I could get it in. So that's why he wanted to do the ICSI injection. So this is where he and I crossed paths, because, you know, my work has always been sperm chromatin structure, and I have all these models about how sperm condenses down into this very crystalline state. But here's a picture of what this DNA looks like. So if you take, so the DNA is just very, very packaged. It's basically like a crystal. It's not active at all. So Jana realized that it's so compact that this sperm, that the chromatin might survive things that other cells wouldn't, right? And so here's just an example. This is a sperm that's very thin section. It's completely black. It's so tightly packed that electrons can't get through it. This is actually a double amount of DNA in a liver somatic nucleus that is much more open and suppressed. So Jana developed this technique in 1976 with mammals called ICSI, cytoplasmic sperm injection. And so this is just one of his ways of really looking at this. So what we're talking about now is taking the sperm cell, injecting it with a needle into the egg, and seeing if it will go to this pronuclear stage, right? And so Jana did this. So here's a sperm cell. Here's the hamster oocyte, and here's a needle holding the sperm. This is how you inject it. You have to have one needle to kind of hold the thing in place, and you have to have another needle to go inside. And so they guarantee you, I know that we do this now in the lab, but we make their own pipettes, right? So they would stretch these pipettes, they would have to build them. This is the apparatus that they showed. I guarantee you, again, Jana drew this picture, I'm sure of it. So here, he did hamster sperm and he got normal things. But even in this first publication, you can see that the real goal was to look and see if dead sperm could do it. He took human sperm, right, and he injected it to see if human sperm would do it. But he also did freeze-dried human sperm. Already he's thinking about, what if I kill the sperm, would it come alive? And you can get a pronucleus, that's about as far as they took it in those days. You couldn't get it much farther than that. So he could show that basically dead sperm could do it, right? So what he was showing was that dead sperm have live DNA. And another experiment that he did was that he took sperm with different temperatures. So he would heat them up. So if you take a normal cell and you heat it past 40 degrees, you kill it. If you take it to 90 degrees, you start to denature the DNA. Even if you kill it, the DNA itself is destroyed. So he thought, how tightly packed is this sperm? And again, he took it a little bit further. He looked at hamster, mouse, rooster, and tilapia. So he got sperm from all of these guys, all of these different species, injected them into a hamster egg, and showed that he could take them to different temperatures and they would survive. So again, the dead sperm have live DNA. And so this has lots of implications, and I'll come back to that into a little bit later. So the human ICSI happened pretty much without Jana. I mean, he might have talked to the people. I couldn't find any evidence that he did it. I know he knows the people, and I know they probably talked to him, but I don't know exactly if he had any point. But the first paper cited ICSI, and this gets to our discussion tomorrow on sort of the workshop on the ethics of the work that we're all doing. But they had a paper that cited the promising technique after births in cattle and rabbits. So people went right, so this group in Belgium went right from, okay, we can do it in cattle and rabbits, so let's try it in humans, right? So they all had patients who couldn't have babies because of this. And the human drive for parents that want to have their genetically owned babies is so strong, right? We'll talk about that again some tomorrow. But it pushes a lot of work. So anyway, ICSI is now the method of choice in clinics. Even if you have good sperm that can swim, ICSI is much easier to manipulate. You could put the needle in and you know exactly the point of fertilization, so you know the timing. When you do IVF, you have to add the sperms. You just let them sit for a couple hours and you take the ones out that are fertilized. But if you do ICSI, you got it fertilized and you know the timing right away. And you can get it much more efficient, etc. So after ICSI in humans, Jana figured out a way to do this in mouse. It turns out that mouse ICSI is a lot harder than human ICSI. With human ICSI, you can just take a needle and punch through the egg and it goes just fine. But mouse has a very strong olemma, the membrane around the egg itself, and it's also hard to get through the zona pellucida. So they were, he really wanted to do this, because just showing the pronucleus wasn't good enough. But if you could get a baby, if you could get a pup out of it, then you say that if the baby was born, then the DNA had to be okay, right? So that was the biological assay. And this is how I got to work with him also, because of this biological assay. So what Jana did, the key thing was piezo. So he worked with a company in Japan who developed this. And piezo is basically like a little drill that's up here. And what he could do is you can just sort of, and when I first got to Hawaii, so I'm reached the stage in my life where my students don't let me in the lab anymore because I'll screw it up. Jana was still doing it, but you know, they don't want me near the lab at all. But I was, when I first got there, I tried to learn this, and I actually was able to do it. None of my eggs survived, of course, but I figured it out. But you drill, you take the needle, you take a sperm, you drill, and then you just simply tap it with your foot. You tap this thing like you're literally drilling through the zona pellucida. Then you pull out the plug and you spit it out, and then you go into the embryo and you stick your needle way down. This olemma is so strong it doesn't break. And then you give it one tap with the piezo and it bounces out and you leave an egg in there. So the piezo was the key to using mouse. And mouse, of course, opened up all kinds of things that you can do. Because we can do experiments on mice, we can't really do experiments on humans to see, okay, let's do this and see if we get a human. If we get half a human, that's, you know, doesn't work. You know, so it doesn't work like that. But mice, you can do this. So now he had not just the pronucleus, but he could get the pup. And so now we can do all kinds of things. Could a dead sperm get a live pup, for example, right? And this really started changing things for him. So he looked at, he did a thing from sonicated sperm. So he took sperm and sonicated them. When you sonicate sperm, so it's basically a sound wave, right? Like this thing that breaks glass. You can break glass with sound, right? So you can break all kinds of other things with sound, like DNA. So a normal cell is packaged with histones, and it's kind of loose. It's really short, and it's packaged nice enough to fit in the nucleus, but it's got to be open enough for the cells to get to it to transcribe and replicate the DNA. If you sonicate DNA, you break it up into 200 fragments, and it's no good at all. It's completely dead. But if you sonicate sperm, and it's in this crystalline-like shape, at a certain level, you don't even break it. The DNA is so completely compact that the nuclei just bounce around, but they don't break anymore, okay? You also break the tails and you break the membranes, but Jana showed that if you sonicate sperm and you inject them into an egg, you can get live pups. So that meant that when you sonicate the sperm, you weren't nicking the china even a tiny bit. Remember, one or two mutations in DNA can kill embryonic development. It's that difficult to replicate. So he, right away, he found these mice that have, we have these mice, inbred mice we keep in the lab all the time, and a lot of them are really screwed up, and these BALB/c have lots of screwed up sperm that look really bad, and Jana said, okay, well, are these chromosomes okay here? So he took these and he injected them, and they looked at the chromosomes and he showed that they were normal. And one of his earlier postdocs, who turned out to eventually to be my wife, Monica, so I'm bragging a little bit here, but she took them later on and she got pups from these. She studied these. These all have Y chromosome mutants and they have these very strange heads, but every one of these can make a pup. So the head is probably, again, these problems with fertility is probably due to the head shape not swimming well, but it's not due to the DNA being packaged incorrectly, and the DNA doesn't have to be packaged in the earth. One of my favorite experiments that he did was something that nobody would think about is freeze-dried sperm, right? So Jana was the guy that was creative, and so he was thinking, okay, so they knew that they could get sperm from cryopreserved sperm. We do this for humans all the time now. But Jana was thinking, well, a lot of laboratories, you know, it's really hard, it's expensive to pay for freeze-dried sperm. And so a lot of labs can't afford the liquid nitrogen and things to do that. So he said, well, what if we freeze dry them and put them in vials, and then you can just store them on your rack, right? You can even maybe do this in the idea. So he showed that he could do freeze-dried sperm, and you got normal pups from this. So this is the mother where they put a white mother where they put a lot of embryos in that should be black, and her babies are all black. So this shows that they came from the freeze-dried sperm. And I remember once before I went to Hawaii, there was a special on, they were taking, you know, Yana was talking, they had interviewed Yana because of this work to say maybe we can resurrect the woolly mammoth because it's freeze-dried in Siberia, and we put it into an Indian elephant, which is the, you know, maybe we can bring back the woolly mammoth. So that was kind of interesting. He also did it, one other thing is he said, okay, well, what about if we can't do it from freeze-dried, what if we have some frozen specimens, right? So let's take some frozen specimens out of the refrigerator and see if we can get techniques from that. And he got mice from sperm that he isolated from frozen testes, right? So that was because of ICSI that allowed him to do this. So ICSI allowed him to ask all of these different questions. And then he had this really interesting idea. So Yana was a sort of a practical guy, and he realized that if I take sperm and I wash them with Tritan X100, which is a really simple detergent, to wash off the membranes to do certain things, every time I do that, the sperm get really sticky and they stick together, and they're kind of hard to work with. He thought, ha, what if DNA would stick to them? What if we could make a transgenic mouse by mixing sperm with DNA and injecting it into an egg? And so he got some people to do this, and he made his famous green mice. So he took some sperm and he added DNA for the green fluorescent protein. When he injected that into an egg, you can already see that when you shine a black light on them, the embryos are green. So that means that the DNA got incorporated into the egg. The sperm did take the gene into the egg. And these mice are born, when the mice are born, they're naked, they don't have fur yet, and their skin lights up with little green mice. So it's all over the place. It's kind of cool. So Yana's contributions to ICSI was to focus on it as a tool to understand how far could you take the sperm. And he was, you know, like, is the sperm dead? Does the dead sperm have live DNA? And how stable is this crystalline DNA? Could we wake it up and make a pup from it? And he showed that in most cases, yes, he could, right? He used it to develop ICSI transgenesis and freeze-dried sperm. And that's, so that was his thing. I mean, his work did lead to ICSI in humans, but again, his drive for that was really to understand fertility. Remember the diagram of coming after different ways of fertility. Rossi, however, is a slightly different thing. By the time he looked at this, Yana had gotten to the point where the world was coming to him for advice. You know, when by the time he started this work, he was already, you know, a god in our field in reproductive biology. And so the big question here now, it started off with a scientific question again. When does the sperm develop its ability to fertilize? So again, when the sperm develops, right, it starts from a normal germ cell with, you know, in humans it has 46 chromosomes. And then it goes to 92 chromosomes, and then it goes back down to 46, and then it goes to 23. And that 23 is called haploid, right? So it's only got one set of chromosomes, right? We all have two sets of chromosomes, one from our mother, one from our father. We have two number ones, two number twos, two number threes, etc. So the sperm and the egg both have to get this down to one. It has to have one number one, one number two, and it mixes and matches, right, from our grandparents. That's not important. In the sperm cell, it gets down to this haploid state, but the nucleus still looks like a nucleus. The DNA is not condensed. Then the next steps are spermiogenesis, is preparation for fertilization. So the sperm nucleus condenses down into this very, very tight crystalline DNA. And the rest of the body turns into this long tail. So this is called spermiogenesis. So Yana wondered, when during this process does the sperm gain its ability to develop, right? Is the DNA here, now it's no longer like very safe, right? This DNA is very susceptible to heating and sonication and freezing. But what if he could inject this nucleus into an egg? This nucleus would never get to an egg by itself, right? This cell can't swim, this cell can't penetrate the egg. But what if I could take a needle and put this nucleus into the egg? Would it develop, right? And so Yana wanted to see, you know, what is the first part of the germ cell that could do this? So this brown spermatid is the first cell that has half the chromosomes. It has DNA that looks just like a somatic cell, so very open, very susceptible to damage. This sperm has this DNA that's in the crystalline-like structure. So it's not fully compacted, but it is haploid, right? And so Jana used his technique to develop this. Now, if we look at these pictures, my old eyes can't see this, but here's a round spermatid nucleus, right? So this is the round spermatid nucleus, right? And that's this thing right here. Look how big it is compared to the needle. So when I'm sucking it in, you know, to me, just looking at it, you know, I worry about just breaking the DNA just doing that. But then he sucks it in, he puts it into the egg, just like he did sperm, but now it's this big nucleus. And he got a mouse from it, right? When he published this, now remember I told you about that chapter that had 1,700 references and 96 papers. But Jana also, when he talked about his own work, so that was a comprehensive book on fertility. He wanted to show the world everything everybody knew about fertility. He wanted to give everybody credit. So he wrote this huge chapter. But when he's doing his own work, in this one, all he needed to do, he would say as little as possible to get the work done. Now most of us, when we're submitting a paper, we try to get into PNAS. They have 4 or 5 pages limit, and they have 4 figures or something like that. So we try to cram everything we can, and it's really hard work to make it that short. Jana published this paper in PNAS. It had 2 pages and 1 figure, because all he needed to show was the mouse, right? And so he was very short and soft-spoken. I love that. When I saw this paper, I was ready to read more, and I got to the end of page 2, and that was it. So eventually he got live pups from ICSI, right? And when he did this, it proved one experiment. Hey, he did this. There's so many examples of this, but he would do one experiment that would absolutely prove this thing. My old boss used to talk about the white crow argument, right? If you have the question, is it possible for a crow to be white and fly around, you only need to see one, right? You only need one example. And then absolutely that sets the field. And so Jana would do experiments like this. So he did this round spermatid, and I have 2 friends, one that works on chromatin packaging by protamines and one that works on the DNA methylation changes that occur between here and here. And both of them, the one guy in the methylation, John McCary, called me up and laughed. He said, you know, Jana just proved all my work worthless, because all of these changes that occur from here to here have nothing to do with development, right? Because you can get a mouse using this DNA. So he showed that all of the changes that occur from here to here, including this packaging of DNA to the crystalline shape, and all the methylation that gets added on during this development, none of that is necessary for development. That was a very clear and decisive argument. This was just before he got nominated to the National Academy, because, you know, he would do experiments like this that would just set the bar and tell you, that's it, right? So then Rossi started in clinics, right? So people started doing this in clinics. And now, at this stage, Jana was really very tightly involved in this. Rossi is something that clinicians are still a little bit nervous about for the arguments that I just said. We don't really understand what's happening. And so even the clinicians who are desperate to help people have babies and the patients who are willing to pay thousands of dollars of their own money, you know, regardless of insurance, to have their babies. I mean, this is such a human yearning. There's a great book called The Baby Business that talks about this. It's just, you can't imagine, unless you're in the thing yourself, this desire to have your own children. Those of us who are lucky to have children naturally, you know, we never had this real pain of not being able to have it. But there are a lot of men whose sperm developed to this stage and they don't develop any further. And so those men would like to have their own babies. Their wives would like to have their husband's child. So the human pressure to do this is really strong. So Jana was working with a clinic in Japan that was developing this. And for the last few years of his life, he was working very closely with them. And they published a paper. Notice he's the last author on this paper. 90 babies were born from Rossi, and they followed them for 2 years using all kind of developmental things and cognitive things to show that they were normal. Jana was absolutely focused on this. So his relationship to his work going to the clinic changed a lot over the years. With IVF and with ICSI, he laid a lot of the scientific background that the clinicians took and used in their practices. But with Rossi, he's the only one who did it, right? There's other people who did some ICSI, there were other people who did some IVF. He's the only one who did IVF in rodents and in with capacitation. He's the only one that did ICSI in mammals. I'm sorry, in mice. But he was the first person to do Rossi, and he was the first person to show it worked. And not only did the scientific thing work, but the clinical side is working too. So Jana's contributions to Rossi is that it's much more his discovery than ICSI or IVF, right? His focus on Rossi was, again, to understand the science, not so much the other things. So cloning. The cloning was a really interesting discovery. I got to know Jana. I had already done a collaboration with him. I'd already stayed in his apartment when cloning came out. And so Jana was really, this was a really difficult thing for him, right? I remember, so what happened was, there were a lot of things that Jana was conflicted about. One of them was that he was second. But Ian Wilmot's group in 1996, they took Dolly, the sheep, they took some mammary cells, they put the cell and they fused it by electricity to get the egg into the nucleated oocyte, and they made a sheep. Now, it hit Nature. It was a cover of Nature, but it was only one sheep out of 275. Again, it was the white crow argument. People at this point, they had cloned frogs. Gurdon cloned frogs, but even he could not get adult cells to clone in frogs. So this was the white crow argument, but it was still only one sheep, and so it was far out. And then Jana had a postdoc, Teruhiko Wakayama, who was having fun. Now, Jana said in his, you know, my research trail, that M.C. Chang said, look, when he was in his lab at his postdoc, M.C. Chang said, look, here's your project that I'm going to give you. This is your bread and butter. You work on this 3 days a week. But 2 days a week, I want you to explore whatever you want. And he said, Jana said, in other words, he gave me freedom. That stayed with Jana. And he gave that to every one of his colleagues who came in. And so Teru took this to light. And he said, Teru was really interested by cloning. And he thought, you know, they're using electrofusion. But what if we did like Rossi? What if we did it with, we injected the sperm into the egg with a nucleus? I bet we could do it much more efficiently and much better. And so Teru brought Jana the world's first cloned mouse. And Jana's first reaction was, we're not a cloning lab, we're fertility, right? But because he, you know, did this, he went with it, okay? So Teruhiko Wakayama, sorry, Japanese names don't roll off as, Teruhiko Wakayama used these two personal days to come up with microinjection to cloning. And they cloned, so they had two papers actually in Nature. One was that this cloning is possible, and the other was that they could do 6 generations of cloning. So these two papers really put cloning on the map. It wasn't a single one-off, one sheep out of 275. This was something that we can do this repeatedly. And so this put cloning on the map. And so why was it different? So when they do the cloning for Jana by nuclear transfer, nuclear injection, you take a mouse, you take the donor, you use a needle to get out the cells from the mother's DNA, and then you take a nucleus, you pick it up, and you stick it into the egg, and you let it develop. And instead of doing here you do the injection instead of microinjection. And then you transfer these oocytes, when they develop, you transfer them to mice, and you get cloned mice. That's how it works. So Jana was very conflicted about cloning, right? And so he sort of dabbled in it for a little bit. I remember being at a meeting where he was talking about his work. He was, this is a big meeting at Worcester Foundation, so it was close to where he did his postdoc. He was invited to give one of these, you know, lifetime achievement awards. And but they had just gotten the paper accepted to Nature, but it was still in blockade. And so Jana, I was at the meeting, and Jana ended it by saying, "I can't tell you any more, but I will say Dolly is not alone." And so, and the place went wild, right? And he got back to Hawaii, and Jana says, he's complaining to me that all these reporters are calling him. Why are they calling me, asking me about this? I said, "Jana, you let the thing out of the bag. You know, you can't just go through this without some repercussions." But cloning brought all kinds of fame to him. So cloning, when they did the work in 1998, Jana, like I said, was a real leader in reproductive biology. The entire world of our field knew who he was. Right, Nobel Prize laureates were coming to Hawaii to visit with him, to talk to him. Every major scientist in the world would take his little trip to Jana, who Jana worked in this warehouse, and he loved it. It was huge and it was ugly, but it had lots and lots of space, and that's all Jana cared about. And it didn't have windows to distract his students from work. You know, he had this one student. I mean, Jana was great. He could push you a little bit too, but he had this one student that came to work with him, and took the weekend off, and he came back on Monday, and the guy found a note on his door. He told us about this later. Guy found a note on his desk saying, dear Ken, we work on weekends too, you know? And so, but this brought all kinds of fame. So a group that, you know, the guy that owns the biggest mall in Hawaii put together, you know, $5 million for Jana to set this new institute, this brand new institute that we now work in. We had trouble moving him over to this institute, but that's another story. He didn't want to leave his warehouse. But it brought lots of money, but then always with lots of money and notoriety, there's all kinds of problems. He could not handle the politics, and eventually it just sort of, and UH did not know how to handle. He did not know how to deal with these biotech companies, and so kind of lost a little bit. So it was outside of this focus. And when we had that flood, Jana lost all of his papers. And so because he kept a filing system, a real filing system, not on his computer. So we all have our PDFs on our computer. He had a filing system, and he lost, you know, drawers, you know, from G through Z. And so he said, "Look, I can't do work anymore in my mouth. So I'm going to work on fish again." So for the rest, so he went back to fish, and he was working on. He would advise other people that were working on it, but he really. He really had a sort of difficult time with cloning. And now Cumulina, the first world cloned mouse, is in the Smithsonian Institute. We finally sent it there. It got accepted there. So Jana's contributions to cloning arose directly from the freedom he gave to his trainees, right? It bred some conflict, but a lot of these things came out of this. His lab verified that, you know, using this technique is now the method of choice to do the cloning. So again, it's the technical stuff. He saw the potential and tried to embrace it, but it just was not something that he had his heart into, really. So last slide. Jana is best known probably for the four topics that I've talked to today, but there is so much more that I just can't even touch on. 400 manuscripts. Most of them were seminal. You know, a lot of them were, you know, he didn't really publish trivial stuff. I think he was, in fact, famous because of this, because he truly did every aspect of fertility available. He was really well, he was an expert in everything, sperm and egg. As an individual, the thing I liked the most about him is that he was genuine. Jana's, whenever he smiled, it was a real smile. He was never false or, you know, different. He was always, you know, right there. He told you exactly what he thought of you. Sometimes you didn't like it, but you always knew exactly where he was. He was never false, never played a game. And if he was mad at you, you knew it. And if he was happy with you, you knew it. But you know, his smile, when you got him to smile, it was this big smile, and it was always genuine. It was never false or first. So that's my talk about Jana. Thank you very much.
All right, so thank you so much for sharing the really inspiring story of Dr. Jana Gamachi. So Dr. Ward and I will now take a seat and open up the floor to any questions that you might have had while you heard about Dr. Jana Gamachi. So the first question I had, so we have a lot of, I think, students and trainees in the audience. So I thought maybe you could share what some words of wisdom or advice that Dr. Yana might share with younger trainees who are thinking about, you know, entering the field of science or contributing to science.
So Yana wasn't much big on words. I can tell you that I'll give you some examples. My wife was a student in Poland who wrote to Yana a lot like Yana wrote to M.C. Chang. And she said, I really want to learn ICSI, and I would like to come to your lab to learn this. And Yana said, okay, but I don't have any money. So she said, well, maybe there's some things we can write together. So she worked hard, and she wrote several proposals, and none of them got funded. But then Yana got a big grant, and he said, okay, I want her. And so she came over. And the reason is because she made the effort, right? She worked hard to actually try to come. So Yana would tell you, I will give anybody a chance. If you work hard, this is what I tell my students now. I'd rather have somebody who has determination and drive. And I think Yana would say the same thing. I'd rather have a student or a postdoc or an associate with determination and drive and not know anything about what we're doing than what we used to call a water walker who could do everything but had no real drive or no real sense of work. Yana appreciated people who did the work. I mean, he took this, you know, the other people in the lab said, why are you taking this Polish girl from a nowhere lab that you wouldn't know, you know? And Yana said he recognized her potential, and she actually turned out to be pretty good. She had two science papers from her own lab with no collaborations, right? So she turned out to be, so Yana recognized talent. He told me once that one of his associates that I was trying to hire said, this person won't work because they don't, you know, they just don't have it. And he was correct, right? He was very good at seeing the potential in people, but he looked at their potential to do the work and the drive and the desire to do the work, not their resume particularly. So he would tell the student, work hard, and don't be afraid, like you said in the movie, don't be afraid to do the work. Just get in there and do it and figure out a way to do it. He would give anybody a shot if they were willing to work.
Great. I think advice for all of us, not just our younger trainees here. Let's see, another question that I had. So he has the, he's the laureate in advanced technology, and I noticed that a lot of the work was possible because of the piezos. Now, I know that he's a reproductive biologist, so how did he think to, you know, look outside his world of biology and think about, as an engineer myself, you know, looking at different technologies?
Well, again, I'll tell you that Yana was always widely read. He was always looking at different places, right? So the Nobel laureate that he had was Garth Nicholson, who was interested in membranes and stuff, and Yana was interested in how membranes interact in fertility. So he would look at, he invited Garth Nicholson to come and work in his lab, and they worked on this stuff. So he would look outside his field all the time. So he found this company. He needed something that would drill a micro drill, basically. And so he found this company that did it, and that's what he was looking at. I mean, he was very sort of simple that way. He said, okay, I need a drill. So do you have anything that can give me sort of a micro drill? And that's what he came up with, a piezo.
Got it. Thank you. All right, so I have a question from the audience. And the question is, would this work make likely to allow two women to have a baby from their DNA? So no sperm involved. You talked a lot about egg and sperm, so I think maybe this question is about that.
Well, this work can lead to it, right? So there's some issues where, actually, my wife had a male student who came to her for the same reason, but from two men, right? There are now techniques led directly from Yana's work, looking at germ cells of, okay, so let me go back. So Monica, because of the techniques that she learned with Yana and ICSI and everything, she made a mouse, a male mouse that had no Y chromosomes, based on the genetics and using Rossi and all of the things that Yana developed and that she learned in her lab. So it is technically, so the genes to make a male all the way down to the round spermatid are outside the Y chromosome. So what that means is that basically, except for making the actual sperm, going from that round spermatid to the sperm, everything is shared by male and female, all the genes, right? And so Jana showed that you don't need that last step, spermiogenesis, to make a male. You can use Rossi, right? So now the question is, can we turn a female cell into a round spermatid instead of an oocyte progenitor, right? And that is possible. So that is being done now in mice. It's a little bit harder to do the sperm from female than the other way around, but people are working on it. We're getting very close to doing that in mice, I can tell you that.
And maybe we can save the question of should we to tomorrow's workshop about the morals and ethics about this work. All right, and then I think we have time for another question. Are there any questions from the audience? All right, question.
Jana tried to have children, but apparently they could not. I don't know the specifics, but they wanted to. That might have been some of the drive later on in life for him helping other couples have them. His wife was a child psychologist, and I really think they wanted it, but I didn't know him well enough to ask that question. Okay, so it's... Do male sperm age, right? So there is some evidence that aged sperm and male have different methylations, and they can pass, they're not as healthy, right? So there's this really interesting set of studies where a group in Australia has taken mice, they make the males obese, and then they take the sperm from the obese males. They use it for ICSI from an oocyte from a normal weighed mother, and that embryo, when it's transferred to normal weather and given a normal diet, has a higher tendency to be overweight than the others. So this is called epigenetics, and sperm are very susceptible to that, just like eggs are. So we change our methylation patterns and our histone modifications in life, right? Through smoking, through drinking, all these kinds of things, and through age. So yes, male sperm age, even though we all know older men who have fathered children, but not as often as younger men do, and maybe not as healthy.
Have you thought or projected at all worldwide where there might be any leveling off in growth of IVF?
I'm not sure.
750,000 a year, do you see?
Well, the problem with IVF now is it's extremely expensive, right? And so that's the limiting thing there. You know, the issue is, and there's actually a whole ethics of making IVF and ICSI available to people regardless of income. In Hawaii, for example, they force insurance companies to allow at least one cycle of IVF. Canada is forcing three now because of twinning, but that's a whole, but it's getting, yeah, so it's coming.
Let's see, I have another question here from the audience. We understand that Dr. Jana had a really strong work ethic and motivation. How did he motivate his team?
Well, I was never the brunt force of being that person, but I remember when I first got there, we had a Friday seminar, for example, and Jana really pushed that we all talk about our work. After the Friday seminar, we were all giving a certain portion of the lab to keep clean. So Friday afternoons after the seminar, we would go clean the lab and then go home. He motivated us most by example. When he was 95, he was still coming into work Saturdays and Sundays and just being there all the time. And so you sort of felt embarrassed about going home before him and not being there when he was there. But he was working. He wasn't just, you know, screwing around in his office.
Have they studied to see if children produced using this method later are more likely to need this method to produce more children?
Yeah, so this is one of the big ethics problems with ICSI, right? So It looks like, yes, that if you're born from ICSI, like if your father's sperm has a genetic defect that doesn't allow it to fertilize the oocyte, if you're male and you're born from that father, you probably will have the same issue, right? And so we are generating babies that will be destined to have to go through this to have their own children, right? Again, it's. I don't think it's going to be a problem with diluting the human genome, mainly because of the cost. But we've all seen science fiction dystopia things where that gets to be the only way to do it, right?
During the presentation, you mentioned how research into freeze-dried sperm cells could lead to us like reviving extinct species like the mammoth. What would some of the obstacles with that be?
Well, the main obstacle would be you'd only get half of a mammal, right? So we know that, for example, that the mammoths are more closely related to Asiatic elephants than African elephants. So you would try to do it with an elephant. I don't think we've ever done ICSI with an elephant, so that's number one. It's hard to do experiments with elephants because pregnancies take almost 2 years, et cetera, et cetera. But once you got a mammoth, it would be half mammoth, half elephant. Then you have to go through the breeding program to try to get out all the Asian elephants, you know, like we do with different breeds of dogs, et cetera. So the breeding there, I think the major thing would be the breeding and the idea that we don't really have the technology to do with with elephants yet. And the expense, of course, but doing it with an extinct species of mouse would be a lot easier, for example, right?
All right, let's take the last question.
And there's also the ethical question of, is it right to bring back an animal that used to live in snow where we don't have a place to put it anymore, you know? The old Jurassic Park question, you know, is it ethically right to bring back a dinosaur in a world where it's not supposed to live?
What are the expected future development in this technology and tactics in this field?
Yeah, so I think the biggest problems are, so one is ROSI. That's the one that I talked about, just using the round spermatid nucleus. That is still, people are still really nervous about it. A lot of clinics don't want to do it because they're making enough money with ICSI and ART. Why risk a malpractice suit for a new technology? So it takes a brave sort of set of clinicians to do that. Or desperate, I don't know, and desperate parents. But the other technologies that people are looking at are exactly the ones that Dr. Kwan brought up about whether gay couples can have genetic children of their own. And the technology, the scientific technologies, we're getting really close, right? There are people who claim to get sperm from somatic female cells. They do it by adding male chromosome genes, but it can be done without it. Or eggs from male cells. That's a lot of it easier because you just got to get rid of one chromosome. When they go through the division, you can get one. So that technology is going to raise a lot of ethical questions when it gets to the point where it's more accessible.
All right, so I think that's all we have time for. But thank you, Dr. Ward, for sharing with us the amazing work of Dr. Yanagimachi.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.